We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
What's going on, everybody? Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, April 11, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network, streaming to you live from artbell.com, darkmatterradio.net. We got a great show tonight. I was gone last week. Last week, I was in New Orleans, busy working on my other job, which is covering pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. Last week was WrestleMania, the big show of the year. Happened to be in New Orleans, and as I had promised everybody, I did go on a haunted New Orleans tour. And I know that a lot of people are waiting for me to tell you all about the tour, and I have good news and I have bad news. The bad news is, I'm not going to talk about the haunted New Orleans tour tonight. The good news is, at the end of the haunted New Orleans tour, I talked to the guide, and he is going to be on this show in just a few weeks. And we're going to talk all about New Orleans, all of the haunted stories, all of the haunted places. It was quite a tour. I had a lot of fun. Very interesting, very wacky guy. He actually does music tours, actually. He does music tours. That's his main tour gig. And so it's kind of fun because there are a lot of different haunted locations in New Orleans, but there are also famous musical venues and spots. Talked to us about the birth of rock and roll. Told a lot of really interesting stories mixed in with stories of hauntings, murder, all sorts of various horrors. And as noted, we're going to get him on the show in a couple of weeks. However, tonight, it's going to be a very interesting show. I presume that you're aware that the movie Noah is out, about Noah and the Ark. Have you seen this movie? Well, tonight, we're going to be talking about Noah's Ark, because we'll be joined live in about 10, 15 minutes by Larry Stone, the author of Noah, The Real Story. It's going to be a very interesting interview here tonight. Noah, The Real Story, Larry Stone. He's been all over the place talking about his book, talking about the movie. He's going to be the guest on the program later on this evening. As always, in addition to the interview with Larry, we're going to be doing all of the normal After Dark related material here tonight, including some emails. Probably take some open line phone calls a little bit later on if you'd like to talk about the interview or anything that is on your mind. We'll be reading a lot of news. And interestingly enough, it's going to be very biblical. It's a show of biblical proportions. Can I say that? Because a lot of the stories tonight are religious in nature. A lot of the news notes of the week just happen to have a biblical tie-in. For example, here from unexplained-mysteries.com is a story titled, "Could Noah's Ark Have Really Happened?" We're going to read about that a little bit, as well as evidence, or the lack thereof, of a forgery in an ancient text which mentions Jesus' wife. I'm going to talk about that here on the program today. That is two, as well as Apocalypse Now. There was a rare astrological event very recently that, according to the Express here, could signal the end of days because it mirrors what the King James Bible predicted would happen at the end of days. All of these stories coming out at the same time. It's fascinating. So we're going to talk about that here tonight. As always, a couple of notes. If you would like to contact us on Twitter this evening, here is what we are going to do. We are going to make use of the DM Radio Net hashtag. If you'd like to contact me on Twitter, I am at Brian Alvarez. You can follow me on Twitter. It was a very, very busy week. I think I added about 1,000 followers this week just because of everything that was happening at WrestleMania. If you'd like to follow me, you may do so at Brian Alvarez. And the hashtag we're using tonight is hashtag DM Radio Net. That is the Twitter hashtag for everything on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And I've decided that every week I'm going to use that the best I can. So if you'd like to contact me, hashtag DM Radio Net, that is the hashtag that we are using. And everybody can communicate on there. If you'd like to ask questions for Larry Stone about Noah and the Ark, you're welcome to do so on there. My email address, brian@wrestlingobserver.com. And you can always send emails to me. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line or the body of the email, After Dark. Of course, that is the name of the show. And that way they will make sure that they get to me. For any of the other information, later on in this program, when we take phone calls, if you'd like to send me emails, if you've already forgotten the email address, if you've already forgotten all of this stuff, all you have to do, and this should be easy, afterdarkradioshow.com. afterdarkradioshow.com. That is our website. Everything is up there. Phone number, email address, the Twitter feed is up there. Last week's show, actually the show from 2 weeks ago, since we didn't have a show last week. If you've not checked out the most recent show, which is available for download on afterdarkradioshow.com, it is Joseph P. Farrell on Nazi Secret Technology. Great show. We replayed it last week since we had some technical difficulties a couple of weeks ago. If you would like to check that show out, I recommend you go up there as soon as possible and download the file, because about 20 minutes after the show goes off the air, that audio show will be history. It will be history, and it will be replaced by tonight's show. So if you've not heard the Joseph P. Farrell episode, strongly recommend you go up there and check that out. And of course, final plugs, make sure you check out artbell.com. A lot of news stories we're going to talk about tonight are on there, as well as our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. My buddy Andrew has done a phenomenal job. This, by the way, also linked up at afterdarkradioshow.com. He's done a great job with this Facebook page. Every time I go up there, we've got more and more followers. He puts up all sorts of great articles, tons of fascinating articles, and he's just doing a tremendous job. We're almost at 2,000. So if you're not a follower on our Facebook page, I recommend you go up there, After Dark Radio Show on Facebook, and like the page and join the fun. All right, before we get our guest on the program here tonight, as noted, we've got a theme this evening, which purely out of coincidence just happens to be stories of biblical proportions. I want to read one of those here because it ties into what we're going to be talking about here tonight. Pretty sure you've all heard the story of Noah's Ark. If not, you are 0 years old. Anybody over the age of one, I'm sure has maybe you haven't even heard the story, but I'm sure that in your room, if you're a child, you've got animals, you've got arcs, you've got little cute elephants. Noah's Ark is everywhere. Everywhere you go when you're a child, there's something relating to Noah's Ark, and it usually involves cute animals. So y'all know the story. But obviously the question is, what really happened? Now, Bible aside, if you study the stories throughout history of floods, of great floods, you know, every great civilization has a story of a flood. Whether or not there was one giant flood, I guess we'll talk to our guest about that here tonight. But could there have really been an ark that two of every animal was put on for a full year, floated around, and then afterwards all the animals and the people came off and repopulated the world? Could this even happen? I mean, story aside, is it even possible? This from unexplained-mysteries.com. Scientists have calculated that fitting two of every animal on Noah's Ark may have actually been feasible. Whether or not you believe that the events in the biblical tale of Noah's Ark literally happened, few could argue that the story has been subjected to a lot more scrutiny than most. And now with the release of the new movie Noah, starring Russell Crowe, physics students at the University of Leicester, I'm sure I screwed that up, set about trying to determine if the Ark could have been buoyant enough to keep two of every animal species on Earth afloat. Basing their calculations on the measurements given in the Bible and the assumption that there are 35,000 unique species to account for, the team determined that the resulting vessel, measuring 144 meters long, would have been capable of carrying the full complement of 70,000 individual animals. Student Thomas Morris says, "You don't think of the Bible necessarily as a scientifically accurate source of information, so I guess we were quite surprised when we discovered it would work." He adds that we are not proving that it is true, only that the concept would definitely work. What do you think about this? What do you think about the idea of Noah's Ark? Fact or fiction? Story or historical fact? Well, we're about to get the opinion of Larry Stone, who is noted as the author of Noah, the Real Story. We're going to get him here on the show, and we're going to talk to him about Noah's Ark. Once again, if you would like to join the program, you're welcome to send your questions and comments to me on Twitter using the hashtag DMRadioNet. And we will go over several of those if people send them during the program. So, without further ado, I'm going to play a little tune here. And as we play the tune, we will get our special guest here on the line. And it should be a good time. So stand by, everybody, in just a moment. Noah, the Real Story. Special guest Larry Stone here on the After Dark Radio Show on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.
Down. And from Patrick.
We're back here on the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio Show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And we are finally joined by Larry Stone here on the program today. And Larry, how you doing?
Brian?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I literally hung up on you three times. I apologize for that.
No problem.
But we have finally got you. And how you doing today?
I'm doing great.
All right, we've got a lot of stuff to get into here today. Obviously, the book Noah: The Real Story, which is available on Amazon.com and a number of other booksellers as well, I'm sure. And first off, what this book? I guess we should start at the very beginning. What? When did you first decide to create this book?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I knew the movie was coming out with Darren Aronofsky starring Russell Crowe on Noah. And I knew that people were going to be wanting to know the backstory all about the Noah story, the ark, the animals, the flood, even the search for the ark, which doesn't relate to the movie at all. And so I began working on that, on the book then, about a year and a half ago, and came out with it just last month.
So the book is very interesting because, and you could correct me if I'm wrong here, but essentially you'd probably do a better job than me in explaining it, but you tackled the book in the sense that if you're a person who just, your mind is closed to the idea that this could have ever possibly happened, the book is not for you. Is that correct?
I won't say it's not for you, but it's interesting seeing reviews because if you're totally closed, you're right. It's not for you. But if you want to at least know the story, even if you disagree with it, then I'd say the book. Take a look at the book.
All right, let's start at the beginning here. So what I thought was interesting about the book, and make sure you get right up close to the phone because we're kind of having a little bit of a connection issue here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Is that better?
There we go. Much better. So the book itself. One of the things that I found most interesting about the book is obviously we've got the new Noah movie. The Darren Aronofsky movie that's just come out about Noah, and it was interesting because you list there's a large number of movies about Noah's Ark that have come out in the past, and it was funny because you noted the most accurate movie in terms of I guess the story of the Bible, mirroring the story of the Bible, is actually Evan Almighty. Is that correct?
That's what I said because. It doesn't pretend to tell exactly the story of Noah, but it does parallel it very well.
So what are some of the, and I don't want to spoil the current Noah movie right now, so we won't tell everybody, I mean, obviously, if you've read the story of Noah's Ark, you got a vague idea of what happens in the movie. But is there a reason that people have done the Noah's Ark story in the past and found some way to, I guess, Hollywoodize it? I don't even know what the exact, the best term would be, but why are these stories not accurate to what's written about in the Bible? Is the story just not exciting enough in the Bible, or why has there been this desire to change the story?
Well, for different sorts of reasons, one of the first movies, I guess the first movie about Noah and the Ark was done in 1928, and it was one of the first talkies. Before that, they had silent films, and this really was a spectacular film. But it was really set as a love story set in World War I. This was before World War II. And then there was a flashback to the story of Noah and the Ark. But there, they mixed up the story of Moses and Samson and Noah and the Ark. And I don't know why they did it, but they did. So, for instance, when God calls Noah, he walks up a mountain. And he sees a burning bush. Now, that's related to Moses, not to Noah in the Bible. And then on the side of the mountain is like a book carved in stone that actually turns its pages as God talks to Noah. And it's why they did that, I don't know. But it's a tragic thing, but the grand finale of the movie where they have the flood, there was actually two or three of the extras that died in the flood because of the so much water.
Wasn't there a deal with the current the Darren Aronofsky Noah movie that just came out? Wasn't there a deal where there was like a I don't know if it was like a torrential downpour? There was something that happened that involved a great deal of water that distracted from the filming of the movie.
Oh, yes. Hurricane Sandy came.
That's Sandy.
They built two replicas of the Ark. One was inside a studio in Brooklyn. The other was outside on Long Island. They built it as if it were going to be 450 feet long. They didn't build the whole 450 feet. But it's a huge thing in Oyster Bay, Long Island, I think it was. And just as they were about to start filming, Hurricane Sandy came through, and it didn't destroy the Ark, but it stopped the filming for a while.
Now, there's a story that I was actually talking about before you came on the air. It was this has actually been all over the place, but I got it from, I believe The Independent actually was the original source, but it's talking about some students that decided that they would try to find out if, in fact, you could fit 35,000 unique species and 70,000 individual animals in an ark the size of the ark as it is described in the Bible. And they came to the conclusion that, in fact, you could. You could really get all of these animals on the boat. And you came to a similar conclusion when you put the book together. And I guess kind of explain to everybody just sort of when you think about you've got this boat and you're getting all these animals on here. I mean, people see the children's story. They see the cute little animals sticking their heads out of the boat. But in real life, this is quite the undertaking to try to put 70,000 animals on a boat for a full year. Kind of give everybody an idea of what you determined was actually possible. Was all of this possible?
Well, yes. The students you're talking about are actually over in England. I think it was the University of Leicester. And
yes.
They did this calculation, and they came to that conclusion. The first question you got to ask yourself when you're trying to determine this is how many animals needed to be on the ark. And the key there is the Bible says that there should be two animals, male and female, after their kind. Now, certain kinds of animals and the birds, God told to bring seven. But most of the animals were to be two, male and female, after their kind. And the question is, does kind mean species, in which case there are between 3 million and 30 million different species, or did Noah have to bring onto the ark a dachshund and a beagle and a wolf and a Great Dane, or did he just have to bring two animals representing the dog family? And those that have looked into it, they say that you don't even need 70,000 animals. You can get away with, or what was needed was probably about 16,000 animals. And that's the figure that is generally used. Then the size of the ark.
So actually, let me cut you off real quick. So 16,000 animals, so 8,000 different species. We're down to 8,000 species?
Not species, 8,000 groups of animals.
Okay.
8,000 kinds of animals. Maybe that's the best term to use. And then the ark is 300 cubits long by 50 cubits wide by 30 cubits high. And, of course, the question is, what's a cubit? It's an ancient unit of measure, usually from the tip of a man's finger to his elbow. It's usually considered to be 18 inches, although every once in a while some people say it's a little bit longer. But at 18 inches, it's a boat 450 feet long by 75 feet wide, so it's a 1.5 times the length of a football field by 40 feet high, and the Bible says it had three decks or three layers inside of it. And, of course, it was probably divided up into rooms. Now, once we get beyond the size and those three decks, everything else is speculation. But you can put 16,000 animals in a boat that size, along with room for the food and room for, of course, Noah and his family, and water to take care of the animals.
Now the big question, obviously, is where did the food come from? Because presumably the animals can't eat each other because you've got to, you know, you don't want to lose any of these animals that you're trying to.
That's right.
I'd seen, you know, people mention, well, you know, there's a lot of hay. Where did the hay come from? Where does the food come from to feed all of these animals for a year?
Well, Noah had 60 to 80 years to prepare for the flood. And it probably took him a long time to build the ark, but he didn't need all that time to do it. And God told Noah to bring the food for himself, his family, and the animals. Where he actually got it, he grew it, presumably, around where he lived.
So have you done calculations, or has anybody done calculations? We know that you could fit the right number of animals on the ark, but has anyone done the calculations to fit the right number of animals and the necessary amount of food?
Yes, and I summarize it in the book. Probably most people don't want to go through all those calculations, so I summarize all of that in the book and refer you, if you really want to study the details, that's available. But yes, a number of different people have gone through and done those kinds of calculations, along with some suppositions about how the ark might have been built. For instance, there's a researcher named Tim Lovett who said if you had this huge boat, and it didn't have to be, it wasn't shaped like a boat as we usually think of it, it was like a great big box. But if it rides inside the waves so that it tips back and forth, it could actually become very unstable. So Mr. Lovett postulated, and we don't really know this is true, but it makes sense that on the front of the ark, Noah could have built a projection, and then on the back, a fixed rudder so that it would act like a wind vane, and the wind itself would turn the ark so it would ride across the waves rather than in and out of the troughs.
Now, when we look at what else that was interesting about the book, when you look at the construction of the ark itself, I mean, everyone, if you've read the biblical story, you know all of the, you know, gopher wood and pitch. And what I found interesting was that, you know, we don't know what gopher wood even is. I guess it's just a direct translation, and we don't even know what this gopher wood was, and when they describe pitch. I mean, we know a lot about it. I mean, there were very specific like measurements and that sort of thing, but what sort of things do we not know about this whole story based on what was told in the Bible?
Well, you're exactly right. The word gopher is not a translation, it's a transliteration. It's the Hebrew letters. One translation, some people think it's a cypress wood. One translation called it a planed or finished off wood. But most of the details of how the ark might have been built are speculation. And it doesn't mean that's wrong, but it's just that we can't say this is how Noah did it. And when we get to how he fed the food, the animals, we don't know this is how he did it. Interestingly, the movie solves the problem of how Noah took care of the animals by having them all hibernating when they get into the ark, which solves a lot of problems, but we don't know that they did. They might have, but we just don't know.
Now, I don't have the stats in front of me, but you might be able to give us some of them. You, in the book, take a look at there are obviously flood myths from flood stories, flood myths, whatever you want to call them, from all over the world. All sorts of different civilizations have these stories. And you there are actually stats about, you know, X number of stories mention a person being told by God to build a boat. X number of stories mention X number of animals. And there are a lot of... Some of the stories are match up. In fact, I believe, if you can correct me, the Native American story actually matches up the best to the story of Noah's Ark in the Bible. Is that right, or was it a different story that matched up the best?
They each match up in different sorts of ways. So, for instance, I tell a Native American story. There's a number of Native American stories, but the one I tell is a Chippewa story. And in that story, if you want to call him the Noah character, his name is Nanobojo, but he and the animals are on a giant log. A similar Native American story, he is on in a giant canoe. And so each one, and then in the South American story, it's in a floating house. So each of these stories is really interesting. They tend to have details that are familiar to the people's surroundings. But what you're talking about there, I mean, you're absolutely right. 95% of these 300 stories around the world talk about a worldwide flood. And they were sent by God to judge the wickedness of man. Two-thirds of them talk about the reason for the flood being God judging the wickedness of man. And so on and so on. So that as you go through the stories, you just see how they're so similar. Not that each one is similar to the other, but taken as a whole, think that they are a collective memory, if you will, of a great worldwide flood.
All right. Make sure you get close to the phone. We're a little quiet. But obviously all of these flood stories from all sorts of different cultures. Now, granted, throughout history, every civilization at some point probably faced flooding. I mean, not necessarily like, you know, civilization destroying flooding, but I'm sure there was flooding in every major civilization that has led to a story. But it is interesting that all of the stories, it's more than just a flood story. A lot of these stories are very, very similar. Now, in your opinion, is this evidence of one gigantic, catastrophic, worldwide flood that affected everybody? Or do you think that maybe there was a very, very catastrophic flood that affected a major civilization, and as the people spread around the world, they all ended up telling the same memory? And so there really wasn't like one worldwide flood, but there was one gigantic catastrophic flood that ended up being told the story around the world.
Well, in the book, we tell several stories about local huge floods. One of the more interesting ones, at least to me is more interesting, is a Black Sea flood. And during the last ice age, the Black Sea cut itself off from the Mediterranean. The Black Sea is over just north of Turkey, and Crimea, that we hear so much about on the news right now, goes down into the Black Sea. Well, when it got cut off from the Mediterranean, it became a freshwater sea, and many people lived around it, and the water level went down. When the ice age ended, according to this theory, the Mediterranean rose and water rushed into the Black Sea through what's called the Straits of the Turkish Straits, and the water level of the Black Sea rose between 400 and 500 feet, flooding miles and miles and miles around it. One of the really interesting things is Robert Ballard, who found the Titanic 2 or 3 years ago, said, "This is a really interesting story. I wonder if I went down in the Black Sea if I could find anything." And so about a year ago, he went down and said that he found evidence of a civilization at the bottom of 400 feet under the surface of the current Black Sea. And the headlines he put out was, "I wonder if this is the civilization that Noah lived in," because the Bible doesn't really tell us where Noah lived. But that's one example of what you're talking about.
So has he done a follow-up? I mean, this was a little while ago. I mean, are there future expeditions heading down to find out what exactly this was, or where do we stand in this investigation?
Well, his report of this came out in December 2012, so about 15 months ago. And at that time, he said, "I'm going to go back down next summer." Well, I watched carefully, and then I tried to contact him and through several different sources. And I don't think he did anything more. So I don't know why, but that was not followed up on.
Now, in the similar vein, many times throughout history, we have seen reports of the discovery of the actual ark. And obviously in the Bible, the ark landed, I believe the exact term is, in the mountains of Ararat. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right.
So we're not talking actual, it's not necessarily Mount Ararat. They are vague, in the mountains of Ararat.
Yes.
So really we have no idea where the ark is even, I mean, not just that we can't find it, we don't even really know where it's supposed to be.
There's several theories. Several thousand years ago, most people focused on a mountain called Mount Judy, which is in eastern Turkey, but the very southern part of eastern Turkey. Later on, there's a much bigger mountain about 200 miles north of there, also in eastern Turkey, called Mount Ararat, and that has become the focus of where most people look for the Ark. There has been many reports of sightings of the Ark, but for some reason, the photograph that has been taken, the piece of wood that somebody says they found, nothing has been convincing, or the photographs have been lost, or the stories just haven't quite panned out. So you're absolutely right. Today we don't know where the Ark is. But people are still searching. Jim Irwin, who was an American astronaut, he went over 2 or 3 times. and we tell a number of the stories of people who have said they have seen the Ark in the book.
Now, you tell a story in the book that I think is just fascinating, because there is a very famous story that comes up. I mean, the story comes up all the time. The legendary Thunderbird photo, where allegedly a giant winged beast, like a dinosaur, like a pterodactyl, was supposedly shot in the Southwest. And this was like in the 1800s. And they took it and they nailed it to the side of the barn. And a bunch of cowboys stood underneath it, and they put their arms outstretched to measure the wingspan of this supposed whatever it was. So throughout the years, you know, so many people have claimed, I've seen this photograph. I remember seeing it in such and such a magazine. I remember seeing it in this book. But no one has ever found the photograph. It's like it is this memory that people remember, but no one has ever actually found it. And it's funny because in your book, you talk about a very similar photograph, an Ark photograph, that it's the same sort of thing. Everybody talks about, I remember it being in this magazine or this book, but no one's ever found this. Tell us about this mystery photograph.
Well, there's two or three of them. I'll tell you one story. In the 1950s, a gentleman named George Green, who was a oil geologist, was over in northern Iran doing some oil exploration, and he got a helicopter, because he had access to it, and flew over Ararat. And George Green said he saw what he thought was the Ark, so the helicopter came down real close. He carefully measured the coordinates of where he was. He took some photographs. I mean, he came prepared, so he had a great camera, so he took photographs. Then he came back over to the United States, and he had to keep working as an oil geologist. But one of the things he wanted to do was to raise money to go back over to Ararat to look on the ground for the Ark that he had seen from the air. So he had showed these pictures to a lot of people. When he was doing some traveling, he left those photos and all of his stuff with one of his friends and then came back and got it. Shortly thereafter, he went down to British Guiana, which is in South America, to do not oil exploration, but gold exploration. The last we know of George Green was that he was found face down in the swimming pool of his hotel in British Guiana. And the authorities, they never said he was murdered, because they never accused anybody of murdering him. They went in his room, and nothing was taken except the contents of his briefcase, which was totally empty. And nobody since has ever seen the photographs of George Green, even though 30 or 40 people will testify, yes, we saw those photographs.
So 30 or 40 people can testify to this, and they've just never been found.
That's right. Were they taken? We just don't know.
Now, who would have been responsible for this murder, alleged murder?
It could have been some people that thought he had gold in his room or in his briefcase, because he was down there working in a gold mine. I mean, he wasn't a miner, but he was helping with the people that were looking for the gold.
So these were people that wanted to kill him for reasons other than Noah's Ark.
They may have wanted to kill him for gold.
I see. The story was just fascinating when I read it, because there's so many parallels to the other story of this Thunderbird photo. I was just reading it, and I was just astonished that it's the same story.
And then there's this other... During World War II, Air Force supply planes went from, I think it was Tangier, Tunisia in North Africa, to Armenia, which at that time was a part of Russia, and supplying a Russian air base in Armenia. Well, if you fly from Tunisia to Armenia, you'll fly right over Mount Ararat. And some of these aviators said that they saw the Ark. And so on one of these supply trips, they took with them, according to the story, a photographer who photographed the Ark. And then these photographs were in an issue of Stars and Stripes magazine.
Yes.
Well, many, many people have said, yes, I remember seeing that picture. In fact, one man said it caused such a stir on the Army base where he was that the chaplain preached a couple of sermons on Noah. But for whatever reason, nobody has ever been able to find that issue of the Stars and Stripes magazine.
Now, was it Time magazine that had the supposed photo of the Ark, and then they found out that it was a natural formation, but they still claimed it was the Ark? What was the story there?
That was Life magazine.
Life magazine.
In 1960, and it had a 2 or 3 page article headlined, "Is This Noah's Ark?" Now, the magazine doesn't ever say, "Yes, this was Noah's Ark," and in fact, it gives some results that says, people have examined it and says this is a natural formation, but you don't sell magazines by saying this is a natural formation and there's nothing to worry about. But that was 1960, and it sort of just went away. It was interesting because it was just a natural formation. About 17 years later, there was a self-taught archaeologist and explorer named Ron Wyatt who picked that up and tried to promote that as being a site of Noah's Ark. But his claims were just so spectacular and so over the hill, and he tried to get more legitimate Ark searchers, like Jim Irwin, who was the astronaut, to agree with him, and they wouldn't agree with him. So that's one of the stories I include in the book as a probable fraud.
Now, wasn't there you wrote about in the book, I can't remember the name, but there was like a Playboy playmate that tried to climb Ararat like 2 years ago, and she nearly died. What happened?
I forget her last name. Her first name's Donna, and she was a Playboy playmate.
The Erico or something?
Yes.
Okay.
That's her last name.
I've heard.
She's a Playboy playmate. She was on Baywatch. She was a Baywatch star. And she became convinced that the Ark's over there, and 2 years ago she went over to look for it and got seriously hurt. Now, she says she's going to go back, but as far as I know, she's not gone back yet. Bruce Feiler, who wrote Walking the Bible, he went over and interviewed several people who said they had seen the Ark. So there's been, even recently, people who have gone over and looked for it, but nobody has actually found it.
Did she fall, or what happened?
As far as I know, yes, I think she fell. Because Mount Ararat is very treacherous.
Yes.
There's several square miles that are covered in glaciers and ice. Unlike most mountains that are 16,000, 17,000 feet high, which is how high this one is, it just rises out of the plains of East Turkey. Most mountains that high have other mountains all around it. So, for instance, if you fly out to Denver I like to go out to Denver and go skiing out there, and you go up, but the mountains, when you go up to a mountains that are 15,000, 16,000, 18,000 feet high, you're already starting at 5,000 feet high. In eastern Turkey, this giant mountain just rises out of the plains, and there's earthquakes, there's it's very, very difficult to explore that. I've never been. I would love to go over. I think my wife would have a fit if I said I wanted to go over to Mount Ararat.
Well, going over is fine. Just don't climb it.
Well, but I'd like to climb it.
You know, there's a great picture, actually, in the book of Ararat, and it's exactly as you state. It's like there are no other mountains around. It's just like a plain, and then there's this giant mountain in the background. And now, what did the Bible mean? I mean, as you mentioned, it's not surrounded by other mountains. There's a mountain there. But in the Bible, it very specifically says the mountains of Ararat. Do we know what they were talking about? What were the mountains of Ararat at the time of the Bible, the writing of this story?
Well, there's no mountains right around that, but generally the mountains of Ararat are considered to be the area from eastern Turkey into from the Black Sea all the way over to the Caspian Sea. So there's another mountain in Iran, Mount Suleiman, where there's another gentleman thinks that that's where, in northern Iran, there's a gentleman named Bob Cornuk who feels that the Ark is over there. So it's although there are no mountains around Ararat itself, there's a whole range of mountains that go eastward into Iran, and those are all considered to be the mountains of Ararat.
Now, the Bible itself, when telling the story of Noah and the Ark, it doesn't really give us any sort of good indication of any sort of time period, correct?
Right.
Now there are people. In fact, I was telling somebody I was going to do the show with you tonight, and their first question was, ask him if there were dinosaurs on the Ark. And apparently there's some people who think, yes, there were dinosaurs. And it really all depends on when you believe this story occurred. But I would presume, like, the general feeling is that there were no dinosaurs on the Ark.
Well, it all depends on how old the Earth you believe the Earth was. Most geologists today will tell you that they believe the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, that dinosaurs died out about 65 million years ago, and of course mankind didn't show up until 10, 15, 20,000 years ago. So clearly dinosaurs and people were not there at the same time. On the other hand, there are people who believe the Earth is only 6,000 years old, and they have an explanation that says that dinosaurs and people did live at the same time. And so if you believe that Noah and dinosaurs lived at the same time, the answer is yes, there were dinosaurs on the Ark. If you believe that dinosaurs and people did not live at the same time, then clearly dinosaurs were not on the Ark.
If you had to hazard a guess, what time period we're talking about in terms of when did Noah live? How many tens of thousands of years ago, thousands of years ago? If you had to hazard a guess, how long ago are we talking here?
We're talking about 5,000 to 6,000 years ago that Noah lived.
Okay. So I guess now the next question would be, and I don't even know the answer to this question. I don't know if anybody does. Because we don't know what gopher wood is. It makes it very difficult to answer this question, but I'll presume gopher wood is some sort of wood. If we presume that this boat was made of wood, would the wood have survived to present day? Is that possible?
I'm going to hazard a guess here. If it is buried under glaciers and ice, I think it would be, because wood that is underwater can last almost indefinitely. So wood rots, not because it's in water, but because it gets wet and dry and wet and dry. So that you have boats that are sunk under the ocean or under seas, and they won't rot. In fact, I have been down, I scuba dive, I've been underwater and seen 200-year-old, 250-year-old boats underwater that are perfectly preserved because they don't get dry.
So we would be talking about, let me see if I can. So the Ark would have landed on the mountain, and the presumption would be that it was in ice for most of the, or what are we talking about in terms of how it would have been preserved?
Well, today, if it's on Ararat, if it is on Ararat and preserved on Ararat, it would probably be preserved under ice that is on top of Mount Ararat.
So there is ice on top of the mountain.
Oh, yes. Several square miles, glacier, ice hundreds of feet thick.
Why have there not been, and you've mentioned it's treacherous, I guess that's probably the best explanation, but why have there not been more expeditions out to try to discover the Ark? Or have there been plenty and they've just been all unsuccessful?
There have been a lot, but they have been generally unsuccessful. They have been unsuccessful. And part of the reason is, yes, it's very treacherous. The other reason is that at least in the 20th century, it is a hugely very politically unstable area. It's right in the very eastern part of Turkey, up against Armenia, near Iran and Iraq. And if you wanted to go over and climb Mount Ararat, you have to get permission from the Turkish government, and they don't give that permission easily.
Now, one thing that you kind of mentioned in the book, and somebody actually also asked me to ask this question today, is Noah himself is Noah is chosen, according to the Bible, because he is a good man, and the world is full of wickedness. And so he has chosen to be the guy that is going to build this ark and save all of the animals and humanity, and everyone lives happily ever after for the moment. Now, when you read the Bible, at the end of the day, Noah is kind of like, I don't want to say he's a shady character, but there's a story of him, and he's drunk, and it's just like a very strange sort of twist in the story, the end of Noah. What happened with Noah? Do we know anything? Are there any other, I don't know if maybe there are books that didn't end up in the Bible that we read today. Do we have any other information about Noah and what became of him?
No. When the flood ended, the water receded, the ark landed on Ararat, and Noah and the animals and his family came out of the ark. He built an altar, he worshiped God, and then we have this story in the Bible, which is exactly what you're talking about, a very strange story in which Noah plants a vineyard. He becomes a farmer, he plants a vineyard, he grows grapes, he makes wine, and he gets drunk. And he's lying there drunk, naked, and Ham, one of his sons, comes in and sees his nakedness. Then his other two brothers, Shem and Japheth, come in backwards with a blanket or a coat over them and cover Noah without looking at him. And Noah turns around and curses Ham and his descendants.
Seems like a very outrageous reaction.
You're absolutely right. And in the Bible, what the Bible tells us does not seem to have enough justification for the curse of Ham. What was called the curse of Ham. Some people think it may be there to give justification because Ham's son that is mentioned as Canaan is that the children of Israel later on went in and subjugated the Canaanites, the descendants of Ham. Many, many years later, this story becomes important to us, if you will, is that when slavery became popular, or we began bringing slaves from Africa to England, to Europe, to the Caribbean, and far more slaves went to the Caribbean, to the United States, and to the United States. This so-called curse of Ham was used to justify slavery. And it was saying that Noah cursed the descendants of Ham. The descendants of Ham, it was said, were black, and so that was used to justify slavery. And it's a great example of where people take the Bible and make it say something that it does not say, and use that to justify their own ideas.
Seems to be a lot of stories like that in the Bible, actually.
The more than I would like to be, but yes, this is a great example of that. And in the book, we quote Martin Luther King, who says, "My friends, this is a perversion of the gospel. Instead, what the gospel says is, in Christ we are all one, neither Jew nor Gentile, male or female, that's in the Bible, and we can add for black and white."
Now, you mentioned in the book, and this is rather interesting, that around the world, including here in America, there are places where you can go and you can actually check out a life-size version of Noah's Ark. Where are some places that, and we got listeners all over the world, so give us a couple of places that people can go if they want to check out a life-size real ark.
The two that are there now today are one in Hong Kong, and in Hong Kong, they were building a theme park on an island in the Hong Kong harbor, and they built it around Noah's Ark. It's a 450-foot long ark that has a museum at the bottom and a hotel and a restaurant up on top. There's also one, this is the only one that floats, and the only one I know of that will ever float, in Holland, because the one in Hong Kong was built as a stationary building.
So the one in Holland is actually a legitimate floating boat.
Yes, and the gentleman that did that, Johan, he built a half-size ark about 12 or 15 years ago, and he and his sons built that, just like Noah and his sons in the Bible. And they floated up and down the rivers and canals of Holland for several years. And then he sold it and built a life-size ark, which opened about a year and a half ago. And so if you go to Rotterdam, just south of Rotterdam, you can see a life-size ark there. There's not one in the United States right now, but next month in Kentucky, about an hour south of the Cincinnati airport, they're going to break ground for a 500-foot-long life-size ark in a theme park called Ark Encounter. The theme park's not there yet, but they're going to break ground next month.
Did the fellas that built the ark in Holland, did they float around for a couple of years, did they bring animals with them as well to test that aspect out, or no?
Yes, they did.
Did they?
Yeah, the larger animals were stationary. I think some of them may have been animatronic, where they move, but they're not real animals.
Sure.
But they had like sheep and rabbits and almost a petting zoo for the kids. And then they had this is sort of cool, although it sounds terrible, but they had places where kids could go in and build, like with Legos or something, build little cities, and then the floods would come and wipe away the kids' cities.
It's terrible.
Yeah. But, you know, that's one interesting thing. We take the story in the Bible, and we usually think of it as sort of a nice story. I picked up a Bible story book the other day, and here's a picture of Noah with all these animals around him and looking sort of like a scriptural Dr. Doolittle.
Sure.
But the Bible, the story in the Bible, it is not nice.
No.
Everything died. And one of the things I'll say positively about the movie is you get that feeling graphically. I mean, you see it graphically. You hear the screams of people dying.
Now, it is interesting. I don't know how far outside just the Noah story we want to go. But at the end of the Noah's Ark story, God puts a rainbow in the heavens.
Yes.
Because he is remorseful, which obviously begs the question, this all-knowing God, why did he kill everything on the entire earth and then show remorse for it later? I mean, shouldn't he have, like, beforehand sort of went, maybe I shouldn't destroy all living things?
The rainbow was not a sign of God's remorse. The remorse of God, I mean, you're right. God's remorse came before the flood. He saw the wickedness of mankind and was grieved or sorry
that he had created it.
That he created us. He gives us freedom to do what we want. And we took that freedom, and because of our sinfulness and wickedness, we turned our backs on God. And that's what he was grieved about. After the end of the story, he makes a covenant or an agreement with Noah and his family and us. He says, never again will I destroy the world by water. And I'm going to make a covenant with you, and I will not do that again. And the sign of that is the rainbow.
So he only promised never via water.
Correct.
So via fire, for example, is fair game.
That's fair game.
And it actually is, I mean, go a little further down the road, I mean, that's supposed to be the end, right? Fire?
Yes. The book of Revelation has some very graphic things in it about how the world might end. And, it talks about fires from heaven. It talks about rivers drying up. Now, how much of that is literal and how much is figurative, I don't know. But it is a very graphic description, and I put it in the book, of how the world might end. And I have also a section on Noah's secret for surviving the end of the world.
That's right.
Which is, quite simply, when Noah was here before the flood, he was out there making the ark, and the people around him, they didn't believe that the flood was going to come.
They thought he was a crazy guy.
Well, yeah, they did. Because, I mean, if somebody came and started building this great big boat in his backyard, you might think he was crazy, too. And he said,
I definitely would, actually. 450 feet, that guy's out of his mind.
That's right. Especially when the animals show up.
Yes.
What is going on? And where this gets all tied together is Jesus, he said, you know, back then, people were just kept on doing all they usually do, and until the flood came. And when the flood came, it was too late to get on the ark, because God shut the door to the ark about 7 days before the flood came. And Jesus says, you know, at the end of the age, I'm going to come back. But when I came the first time, it was as a baby, almost in disguise, if you will. When I come back the second time, it's going to be in power and glory, and everybody's going to know who I am. But what you have to do is just like then, once I come back, it's going to be too late. You've got to choose now whose side you want to be on. You have to choose now whether you're going to follow Jesus or not. And that's the analogy that Christ himself made. And so Noah's secret for surviving the end of the world is watch, be ready, and choose now whose side you're on.
We're on After Dark Radio, everybody. Brian Alvarez here. We are joined by Larry Stone, the author of Noah, The Real Story, available on Amazon.com. Find booksellers everywhere. We got a few more minutes here, and I had a couple of other questions. Speaking of arcs, a completely different arc, the Ark of the Covenant, another missing ark that people continue to look for. Have you done any research into the location of the Ark of the Covenant?
No, I haven't. But it's really what's really interesting is in English we use the same word, Ark of the Covenant, for Ark of the Covenant and for the Ark that Noah used. In Hebrew, they're two entirely different words. And in Hebrew, that word is only used twice in the Old Testament. Once for the ark that Noah built, and once for the little boat that Moses was in, that his sister put him in when the Pharaoh was killing all the Hebrew babies. And so we don't know what that Hebrew word means. Does it mean boat? Does it mean something that saves you? Because both of those saved people, Moses and Noah. But the Ark of the Covenant uses a whole different word.
Now, have you followed any other, I mean, are there any other biblical stories that you've followed in an attempt to, I guess, similar in the way that you've attempted to determine whether or not the story of Noah's Ark is feasible? Everybody I talked to today that knew that you were on the show had all these questions. And one of them was wanting to know if you knew anything about Jonah and I can't say the whale, the fish. If you've ever investigated that story in any depth,
not to the depth that I've investigated Noah. The story of Jonah and the fish is where he was fleeing from God, and he was on a boat going in the exact opposite direction from where God wanted him to go, and told him to go. And then there's a huge storm coming up, and the sailors on the boat were thinking, you know, we're going to drown. And Jonah says, you know, the reason for this storm is because I'm running away from God. And so they throw him overboard. And
perfectly logical reaction.
Yes. And then the Bible says this fish came and swallowed him, or picked him up and took him and put him on, I think it was for several days he was in the belly of the fish, and then put him on the ground. And at that point he got the clue and went the direction God wanted him to go, which is to Nineveh.
So have you ever investigated? I mean, I don't know how far you've studied this. I mean, are there stories of people that have actually been swallowed? I presume that it was a whale. If it's large enough to swallow a man, it's got to be pretty sizable. Are there stories of individuals that have actually ended up in the belly of a whale and come out of it alive?
I think so, but I'm not. I mean, My memory says I have heard those kinds of stories, but certainly not well enough to be able to recount any of them to you or to say yes for sure.
Are you planning on writing? I mean, do you have any of the projects you're working on right now? What is, do you have, I mean, you've written the book about the Ark, but I would presume that you still follow the story regularly. And when you know, the next expedition goes up, you're going to probably be following it pretty closely. But what kind of projects are you working on? And is there anything Ark-related, Noah and the Ark, that has come out since the publication of your book?
Well, one of the things I did want to mention is there's a website connected with the book. The website is knowoftherealstory.com. And one of the things I put on the website, which is not in the book, is a discussion guide for the movie. Because while I'm not going to say to anybody, you really got to go see the movie, I am going to say that if you're going, here's how I'd recommend doing it, and that is to take several friends with you, and then afterwards go out for pizza or to have something to eat, and to sit and talk about it. I'm blown away with all of the discussion about this movie. I read somewhere where somebody said last week you could Google blogs about Noah or something like that, and there were 1,400 come up. So there's a lot of fodder here for talking about all kinds of different avenues. And so I got some discussions that will get you started, and so you can find that on the website.
Now, wasn't there like a showing of the movie? I swear to everybody, there was like a showing of the movie that got canceled due to a flood.
I don't know about the showing of the movie. I know that the filming of the movie got postponed because of the Sandy flood in Long Island. I hadn't heard about the showing of the movie getting canceled, but that'd be interesting.
I just read about that like a couple of days ago. There was like it was scheduled to... Yeah, here we go. Actually, this is from Time Magazine, in fact. The View Cinema in the UK city of Exeter had to scrap a showing of the movie because of flooding caused by an ice machine gone wild. I guess it's not as good as, like, you know, a rainfall, but still, a flood prevented the showing of this film.
Yeah, wow.
Now, your book just came out at the end of January, and I can't remember when exactly the Noah movie came out, but you talk about the movie in the book. Had you had a chance to see Noah before the book was published, or did it get published, like, right before the movie came out?
Well, realize that I also had to finish the book before it came out for a while. So before the book came out, I had read this a script that was a couple of years old. I had seen many, many clips of the movie. But before the book came out, I had not seen the whole movie. And in fact, the movie forms only a very small part of the book.
Yes.
My intention was not to focus on the movie, but to focus on the story of Noah.
Tell everybody very quickly about Darren Aronofsky himself. I mean, I know of Darren Aronofsky because my other job is, I cover pro wrestling, and he did a movie, The Wrestler.
Right.
And so it was interesting, this, you know, Darren Aronofsky doing this movie, but I was unaware that, like, the Noah story was something that he has been fascinated in since he was, like, a child. Is that correct?
Absolutely. When he was, I think it was 13 and living in Brooklyn, he was asked to write a poem, I think it was. And I don't know whether he wrote it for this contest or whether it was later entered into the contest, but he won an award from the United Nations for this poem that he wrote about the Noah story. And so,
from the United Nations?
The United Nations. And so it has fascinated him since he was a young boy, 12, 13. And so first of all, he and Ari Handel, who is his co-writer, they wrote a graphic novel about the Noah story. And their graphic novel and the movie is inspired by the story in the Bible. But their research comes not just from the Bible, but from extra-biblical material such as the Book of Enoch, which is not is very old writing, but it's not considered part of either Hebrew or Christian scriptures. And so they took the themes that they saw in the Noah story and then tried to elaborate on them to tell the story they wanted to tell, and also to help the viewers or the readers of their graphic novel to wrestle with the issues brought up in the Noah story.
Now, the book, everybody, is Noah, The Real Story. We're talking to Larry Stone right here, and as noted, there is a website up, knowoftherealstory.com, which you should obviously check out if you're listening to this right now, or if you get the book. As he noted, there's a lot of A lot of interesting. It'll tell you how to talk about it, how to go to the movie, and what you should do afterwards, and obviously information about the book as well. And I want to give you a chance before we go to get any plugs out here. Tell everybody all the various places that they can get the book, any other projects, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you're interested in. Now's your chance to get the word out.
That's great. Well, the book was published by WND Books. That's W. N like Noah, D like David Books, and you can get the book there. You can book. There's several links on the website, knowathereelstory.com, where you can get it. There's a discussion guide for the movie on the website. There's also a place, if you have any other questions or want to get in touch with me, where you can do that through the website.
Noah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's another book that I wrote is on the history of the Bible called The Story of the Bible, and there's a website for that. It's just storyofbible.com, and there you can read a lot of information about the history of the Bible, how it was written, how it was translated, ancient manuscripts. It's actually some pretty interesting stuff on there, so I'd recommend that too.
All right, knowathereelstory.com is the website to go to if you're interested in this particular book. And as noted, storyofthebible.com is other book. And that available, I'm sure, amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, all of the major booksellers. And if not, you can check out both of those websites for more information on both. And perhaps I shall check out storyofthebible.com, and maybe we can get you back on there to talk about that one.
Okay, that'd be great.
Well, I really appreciate it today. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program today, and best of luck with the book and everything that you do in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. I enjoyed it very much.
And I want to thank you once again, and of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back in just a moment, everybody. We will be talking all of the news and a lot more. So stand by. Back in just a moment, you are listening to After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Back here on the show, everybody. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio Show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. That was Larry Stone, the author of Noah, The Real Story. I'm going to apologize a little bit. I know we had a very shaky phone connection, but hopefully everybody was able to hear that as best as possible. I'll try to make sure that doesn't happen in the future, but a very interesting interview, and I will perhaps check out Story of the Bible. I really would like to, and perhaps get him back on to talk about that. A lot of very interesting stories there. Regardless of whatever your religion might be, Bible is a very interesting work. And a lot of different things talked about. And of course, as if you've ever watched, for example, Ancient Aliens or read any books in that sort of vein, there are some very interesting and mysterious things that are written about in the Bible. Story of Ezekiel, for example, and many others. So perhaps we'll get on him on at some point and talk about that. All right, for the rest of the show, we've got a lot of very interesting news articles to talk about, as well as some emails. Once again, if you would like to contact me here on the program throughout the rest of the show, hashtag DMRadioNet. If you'd like to contact me, you may do so there. And in addition to that, emails, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com. I'm going to be reading some emails here tonight. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line. If you don't put After Dark in the subject line, it is possible that I will not see your email. So make sure you head over there, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com. After Dark in the subject line. Let me know what is on your mind. And the phone lines for the rest of the hour are open. Toll free in the United States and Canada. The phone number is 855-478-4478. If you'd like to give me a call, once again, that is 855-478-4478. Give me a call, whatever's on your mind. You can talk about the interview that we just did with Larry Stone. You're welcome to talk about any of the news articles that we've talked about here today and are going to talk about here. Whatever is on your mind, strange stories, you've got ghost stories, whatever you've got, we would love to hear from you here on the program. Once again, 855-478-4478. Give us a call right now. Going to read this email here from Paul. This is about a haunted doll. This is Brian. I've been listening to the After Dark radio show over the past few months. I have to say I love it. Kudos to you for doing the show. A while back, you were speaking about haunted dolls. I thought I would share my story. I was about 8 years old, and my mother had bought me an Action Man toy. It was of a police officer and his German Shepherd police dog. You could record short phrases for the toy to shout out. You'd press one button to record, and then press playback. It had a record time of approximately 5 to 10 seconds. Just long enough to shout, freeze, stop, police, etc. Anyways, I put the toy to one side, forgot about it for 6 or 7 months. One afternoon, I picked up the doll and decided to listen to what I had last recorded on it. I expected an 8-year-old boy to shout out police or something familiar, but no. Instead, what I got was a recording of the lady who lived next door. She was giving her son a bath. The audio was totally different. Instead of it being low-grade and choppy, it was crystal clear. Think high-definition 2014 audio quality. Not only that, but it did not stop. Not at 5 seconds, not at 10 seconds, not at 30 seconds. By this point, I was freaking out. I called my mom for help. She couldn't work out why this toy was giving out a recording of the person next door. How could this be possible? The toy just kept talking over and over. The mother began telling her son off in the audio. The volume grew louder and louder, screaming in a mixture of English and Filipino. And by the way, the lady was mixed British-Filipino descent. This kept going and going. My mother was freaked out, took the batteries of the toy out. However, it still kept talking. It did not have solar power or anything like that. Without batteries, this thing just kept talking. By this point, we were both screaming and shouting at the toy to stop, but it just got louder. My mother then got a hammer and proceeded to hit the toy over and over with it, but it still did not stop. No batteries, hit the hammer, impossibly clear recording, all happening. What was this thing? Our two cats were jumping around, making the hissing noise at the toy. I swear at this point that it moved on its own, but that might have been my hallucinations due to fear. We put the toy in the microwave to kill it, but before we turned it on, the recording just stopped. I took the toy out of the microwave. I shoved it to the back of the cupboard. My mother gave the toy away at a charity fair, and thankfully, I never saw the thing again. How can a toy with a 5 to 10 second record time with choppy audio play something through a wall for 10 plus minutes? HD quality in the 1990s. How could it live without batteries and solar power? How could a plastic toy survive being smashed dozens of times with a hammer? How can it move on its own? What was this thing? This was the first of many unexplained things during my lifetime, but this one stuck in my mind. And thank you for listening to my insane story. That is from Paul. My question, Paul, is did you go next door and find out what was going on with his mom and her child? This sounds terrible. It's not the same story. Your story is significantly more frightening than the story I'm going to tell. But I've got this fire alarm here. And woke up one morning and the fire alarm is doing the low battery beep. It's going beep. Every 30 seconds, beep. Of course, keeping me awake. So I'm like, oh my gosh, it's driving me nuts. So I wanted to go back to sleep. It's early in the morning. So I woke up and I came into my room and I was like, all right, I'm going to get on a chair. I'm going to just unscrew this thing. I'll take the battery out, go back to sleep, and I'll replace the battery when I get up. We have many smoke detectors in the house. It's not like if I unscrewed it, you know, this is when lightning would strike and my house would burn down. One missing fire alarm was not going to be the end of the world, although it was in the office. And there's, you know, electrical equipment all over the place. But anyway, so I get a, you know, a stool or whatever, stand on it, unscrew the fire alarm. And I pull out the battery and I go back in my room and beep, beep, still beeping. You got to be kidding me. I took the battery out. Why is this thing still beeping? So I go back in, and not only do I take the battery out, but now I'm so infuriated by this thing. It's like hanging from the ceiling by those two. There's like, you know, the two cords that plug into the battery, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna undo these two things. So I essentially tear the thing out of the ceiling, unhook all of the cables. It's got no battery. It's got none of the cables are hooked up. There's nothing in it, and I put it down. And I go back and I lay down and what do I hear? Beep, beep, thing's still beeping. So now I'm like infuriated. And so I go in my room, I grab it. I literally go out of the house and I like throw it into the grass. I'm like, just get this thing out of here. And then I go back in and I go to sleep and, you know, the beeping stops. But I was infuriated because like there's nothing. Everything, it was unplugged, there was no battery, there was nothing, and the thing kept beeping. And so finally I go and I wake up, I go get the smoke detector, and I put a new battery in it, and I plug the thing back in, put all the cords back, screw it in, and I start coming over here to work, and what do I hear? Beep, this thing's still beeping. I'm like, you've got to be kidding. I got a new battery in there. Now I'm infuriated. And so I go and I take the battery out. I unplug it. The thing's still beeping. I'm like, this thing is determined to kill me. And so finally, I go back downstairs. I find a brand new packet of batteries. And as it turns out, the new battery that I'd put in was a... I guess batteries now have an expiration date on them. If they always had this, I just now noticed. But this battery expired. It was a new battery. But I not used, I bought like a big pack of batteries a long time ago, and I hadn't gone through all of them. So these batteries had expired, apparently. And I put a brand new battery in, and the thing stopped beeping. But I thought for sure I was being haunted by this smoke alarm. Just everything unplugged and beeping just drove me out of my mind. Not a haunted doll, though. A haunted doll, you know, that's much more terrifying than my story. But there you go. It's from Ryan here. I have some suggested viewing for you and other fans of After Dark-esque topics. Comedian Rhys Darby has a new television series out called Short Puppies, which is available on Netflix. The premise is that in each episode, Darby plays a different character being profiled in a mockumentary about everyday New Zealanders. Second episode of the series focuses on Darby playing a ufologist / conspiracy theorist. It was a near-perfect parody of anybody who I've ever heard interviewed about alien abductions and the like, though was done in a way where it did not come off as mean-spirited, and I think that even people who are into the paranormal would get a kick out of it. It's an easy 22-minute watch. I have a feeling most After Dark listeners would get a kick out of it. That is from Ryan. Short Poppies, it's called, and it is available on Netflix. So head up there and check that out. Once again, if you want to give us a call, phone number is 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. I'm going to do it again. I'm not asking you to call in. I am commanding you to call in. Because when I ask, nobody calls. When I command, I usually get some calls. So I'm commanding you, the listener, give me a call right now, 855-478-4478. What is on your mind? By the way, later on this evening, after the show goes off the air, only for those of you listening live, this does not show up on the replay. If you are listening to this on a recording, you're not going to be able to hear the after show. The after show is a special treat for those of you that are listening live. Immediately after the show goes off the air, it is the After Dark After Show. Myself and our illustrious webmaster, the legendary, I will go as far as to say, Keith Rowland, the original creator of the ArtBell.com website, still running it today. It is going to be the After Dark After Show with me and Keith. We're going to be talking all sorts of topics, including the death of the Ultimate Warrior, for those of you who are wrestling fans, in Keith's neck of the woods. So we're going to talk about that on the program. And now it is time to go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, buddy, this is Kirk from Canada. How are you doing?
What's going on, Kirk? I just saw you this weekend.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah, nothing much. Yeah, I just wanted to mention the haunted tour of New Orleans.
That's right.
What do you think of that?
I enjoyed it. I have not talked a lot about it because I'm going to get our tour guide on the program here in the next couple of weeks, and he is going to tell us all of the stories of haunted New Orleans. But since you're on the line, what did you think about it?
I thought it was pretty good.
Pretty good? What was your favorite story?
Well, I don't know if it's what you call a good story, but yeah, aside from the Lafitte brother pirates, the story of, Marie Lalaurie?
Marie Laveau?
Her too, but yeah. No, it's the woman who had the house where she would,
the torture house.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a tough one to listen to. She did all sorts of terrible things. We're talking like, she would take the legs off one person and the arms off another person, and then she would sew the legs where the arms had been on the other person, and all of these just terrible, horrible experiments. But, go ahead.
Outside of what looked like a perfectly lovely house, too.
Hey, it looked lovely, but inside, I'm sure, very different. You know, the only thing that disappointed me was we were going to tour the cemetery, and the cemetery ended up being locked. And as I found out later, it actually closes at noon on Sunday. So we'd never have been able to get in there on this tour. But I would have liked to have gone in there and seen, Nicolas Cage's pyramid?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nicolas Cage apparently built a pyramid. And boy, did this tour guide had some Nicolas Cage stories. Not a fan.
Yeah.
Not a fan.
I would like to have seen that too, just for, just for basic. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I got a cat that's wanting to sit in my lap right now.
You got a crazy animal over there?
Yeah, I got a crazy animal.
Did you hear the Noah's Ark interview?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of this?
Interesting, but yeah. I'm what you call one of those non-believers.
An atheist or just a skeptic?
It's leaning towards atheist.
Leaning towards atheist. No Ark?
Interesting story, but...
No Ark?
No Ark, no.
No Ark. Now, what do you make, though? I'll ask you this question. What do you make of the fact that every major civilization has a flood story?
Oh, there's floods in a lot of places.
So just localized floods everywhere, and some were traumatic, and thus these stories got spread.
Yeah.
Well,
pretty much.
A lot of people in the same boat, I got to tell you.
Yeah, like, we had a horrible flood around here.
But not so horrible that you're going to tell your family, your children about it.
No.
No.
nobody built a dry boat either. But
well, you know, maybe next time it floods.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I want to thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it. It was great to see you in New Orleans as well, my man. And back to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, Brian. It's Sammy from New Jersey.
Sammy, what's up?
I didn't have too much to call about, but you commanded me, so I'm calling.
You've got me in the background, I see.
I'm trying to lower the volume. There we go.
What did you think of tonight's interview? Are you a skeptic?
To be honest, I was working, and I was kind of listening. You know, I was paying attention to work and do it and listening at the same time, so I really don't know everything he said. In regards to Noah's Ark, I'm one of those people who really says you really never know what you can believe, especially in the past. And I was actually having a conversation with my friend earlier about, you know, we were watching a show that just came on Fox recently called Cosmos, talking about...
Oh, yeah, the new Cosmos.
Yeah, and he was mentioning how, like, very religious people were very angry at the show. And I watched and I understood the first episode and understood why. And he was having, you know, saying how it's logical, like the theory of evolution and stuff.
Well, tell me what people were upset about in this new Cosmos.
I don't know what they were upset about, but it was pretty clearly, like, the one thing that stuck out with me in this episode was there was a scene of a gentleman who was trying to say that Copernicus was correct in his beliefs. I think it was something around 1600s, and he was... it was like they were treating the people who were, you know, on the other side, the more creation, you know, religious side. You have to forgive me, I'm out of it. I had a really bad week. Religious side just seemed a little bit more like a negative connotation, almost like heels at one point in the episode. And, you know, it is the opposite of what creationists believe. So anyone who's stating it as fact, they're not going to be happy with, I guess you would say. Just like I get the evolutionists would sort of feel the same way about creationists.
Have you been watching all of the new episodes of Cosmos?
Tonight was the first night I saw it. Ever.
Okay.
So it's the only one I've seen. So
I've heard it's very good.
It seemed very good. The conversation was about... my point was about evolution being logical is I've always thought this, that time in itself, there are certain things about life that are not, that have no logic. And that to me is the beginning of time and the end of time. Like if that is a fact, well, how can there be a beginning and an end if, put it this way, we always talk about the Big Bang Theory. If we assume it's true, I mean, scientists know that they can't answer this because you can't answer it. Where did that come from? Where did I like to call it the Little Bang, developed into the Big Bang? You know, logic says it had to come from somewhere and then it had to come from, it's kind of like the chicken and the egg thing. It's like there is no logic to the start of time and the end of time because what came before that? You know, describe what the universe is like if nothing exists. And anything that you say ends up being something. So, I don't know. To me, that makes life... That's why you said there's really no answer to anything that you can be certain of in ways like that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. I haven't had a chance to check out Cosmos yet, but... yeah, the beginning and end of time. What does that mean? How can you have a time before time? My theory, I guess, was always that when it all came into being, there was time. And thus, before that, there was no time. Does that make sense? I don't even know if that made sense when I said it. But, yeah, the idea of a time before time. Evolution is a very fascinating subject. Because... I don't even know where to start. So you know what? I'm not going to start. Someday we will do a story. We will do a show. We will interview somebody. We'll interview somebody about this topic and see what people have to say about it. Some people, I just feel that the very idea of evolution is so abhorrent to them that they don't consider any aspect of it whatsoever. I don't even know if what I just said there made sense. But some people are just the very idea of it. The very idea of it is just such a negative to them that they don't consider the fact that, in my opinion, if you want to believe, do I even want to go here? You can be a person who believes. In fact, I should have asked our guest tonight about this topic. There are aspects of evolution that you can believe if you even have a literal, I'm talking 6,000, the Earth has been around for 6,000 years. If you believe in the Bible to the point that you believe the Earth has only been around for 6,000 years, there are still aspects of evolution that will fit into your belief system. It's true. Things do evolve. And I just, I think that people who really have a negative view of the idea of evolution have never really looked at it and thought about it. I think it's just something where the very idea of it is abhorrent to them, and so that's the end of that. Nothing more to discuss. It's just, it didn't happen, that's it. And I think that maybe it would be something that maybe you could look at and investigate and then make a decision about. This article here on the topic of religion is from the Boston Globe. New scientific tests have turned up no evidence of modern forgery in a text written on ancient Egyptian papyrus that refers to Jesus as being married, according to a long-awaited article to be published Thursday in the Harvard Theological Review. Well, where the heck's my update? Looks like I've got an old article. Let's do a quick Google search here. Jesus wife fragment. What is the very latest on this story? Is there an update from Thursday? Because I don't see an update in the last 24 hours. Nope. The latest is the same story from The Independent that I just read. Well, where's the update? A Harvard professor is claiming a fragment of a papyrus seemingly mentioning that Jesus had a wife is an ancient document and not a forgery. Following a series of tests. Text is written in Coptic, contains a dialogue in which Jesus refers to, quote, my wife. Karen King, a professor at the Harvard Divinity School, writes in the Harvard Theological Review, I guess this is an update, that the papyrus is almost certainly a product of ancient Christians and probably dates to 8th century Egypt based on carbon dating and chemical tests on the ink. None of the testing has produced any evidence that the fragment is a modern fabrication or forgery, Professor King and her team concluded. The fragment, which has some legible lines at the front and on the back, contain the words, quote, Jesus said to them, my wife, she will also be my disciple. James Yardley from Columbia University and Alexis Hagedorn used a technique called micro-Raman spectroscopy to determine that the carbon character of the ink matched samples of other papyri that date from the 1st to 8th centuries CE. And Malcolm Choate of the McGuire, I believe that's how you pronounce it, University examined the fragment at HDS and offered an independent assessment of the handwriting. Professor King first announced the existence of the fragment in September 2012 at the International Coptic Congress in Rome, where she dubbed it, quote, the gospel of Jesus's wife. What would that mean? What would that mean if Jesus had a wife? What would the reaction would be among the Christian community to that announcement? The gospel fragment provides a reason to reconsider what we thought we knew by asking what the role claims of Jesus' marital status played historically in early Christian controversies over marriage, celibacy, and family. Well, there you go. Also here, I thought it was funny because of the way that this was written here. They're talking about a rare astrological event. What to you is a rare astrological event? I'd say Halley's Comet. It's pretty rare, right? How many years? Like, is it 88 or is it more than that? Let me find out. I used to know this when I was a child. How often does Halley's Comet come around? Is it 88 years? 75 to 76 years. That to me is a fairly rare event. 75 to 76 years. But this year says, Mars, Earth, and the Sun all aligned last night. A rare opposition of the planets that only happens once every 778 days. That's like 2 years. That ain't rare. Especially astronomically, that's not rare. Every 778 days, that's downright frequent. Anyway, what made this event so remarkable is that it occurred precisely a week before everyone on Earth will see the first of four dark red blood moons. An extraordinary event, some Christians believe represent the end of days and the second coming of Christ. The King James Bible predicts, "The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and the terrible day of the Lord comes." And according to NASA, which is not the Bible, by the way, a highly unusual tetrad, four successive total blood red lunar eclipses, each followed by six full moons, will indeed start next Tuesday and finish on September 28, 2015. This is rare. This incredible alignment has only happened a handful of times in the last 2,000 years, actually. But remarkably, on each of the last three occasions, it has coincided with a globally significant religious event. So there you go. Four consecutive total lunar eclipses will occur in 2014 and 2015. There's actually some great artist renditions here. It's actually really amazing. This is express.co.uk, and this will be sent to our webmaster, Keith Rowland, and hopefully you will get that up on artbell.com. Apocalypse Now, it says. This is weird. This would be something we could have talked to Joseph P. Farrell about. The weird weaponized animals of World War II. What? The escalation of World War II brought with it an arms race of epic proportions, with each side racing to develop various weapons technologies with which to more efficiently kill each other. The time of frantic weapons research brought about some of those deadly weapons the world had ever seen. The atomic bomb perhaps being the most notable. Yet it seems that the human capacity for imagination knows no bounds, including in the realm of weapons of war. While some engineers were designing newer and deadlier aircraft, bombs, missiles, and other mechanical means of devastation, still others worked in the shadows of secret labs, perfecting ways to turn animals into weapons. The results, while by no means always successful, were some of the most bizarre attempts at weapons of war ever devised. Here are some of them. Bat bombs. The idea was for millions of bats, specifically the plentiful and easily obtainable Mexican free-tailed bat, to parachute toward Earth in an egg-shaped container carrying small incendiary devices strapped to them. A bat bomb. That is no buys. Anti-tank dogs. There's actually a photograph here, I swear to God, of an anti-tank dog. Anti-tank dogs were dogs that were taught to carry explosives to tanks, armored vehicles, and other military targets. They were intensively trained and developed by Russian military forces from as early as 1930. Originally, the dogs were trained to carry an explosive device to a wide range of targets and then release the bomb, after which they would run away and the device would be detonated by timer or remote control. So yes, the dogs were smarter than the suicide bombers who end up committing suicide. The dogs just dropped off the bomb and got the hell out of Dodge. Dogs would become confused about their targets, however, and would sometimes even return to their masters with the explosives still attached to them. A potentially, it says here, alarming development. You don't say. Rat bombs. Which reminds me, by the way, when I was in New Orleans, it's kind of a dirty place, not going to lie. And if you live there, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But I was doing a radio show outside, and I was by a fence, and talking into the phone. I'm doing my radio show, and all of a sudden I hear like something like that. And I turn around and rat running across the top of the fence. Not a fan. I was not a fan. So the British here, not to be left out, it says, of the insanity of using animals as weapons, developed a method of delivering explosives that involved the use of dead rats. They took rat carcasses, filled them with plastic explosives, left them in targeted locations, and it was speculated the stokers tending boilers would dispose of the revolting find in the furnace, thereby detonating the bomb and destroying the factory. Rat bomb. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian, this is Shane. I'm calling from Orange County.
Shane, what's up?
Hey, I had a weird one for you, but you were talking about weaponized animals.
Oh, yes.
Another person that talks about weaponized animals a lot is professional wrestler Teddy Hart. I don't know if you remember his weird shoots about
cats
how to wrestle.
Yeah, I didn't see him, but I know that he went to a wrestling show. He went to the Dragon Gate show on Saturday night and Friday night last week with his cat. He comes to the awesome. Ring with his cat. He's trying to train his cat to run interference during his matches.
Do you think by any chance he happened upon some of this old Nazi secret technology and is trying to weaponize these kitty cats?
And no, he is trying to weaponize. He's trying to weaponize the animals. That's true.
See, he wants. I mean, he was talking about getting making a ring with escape ramps, and cats are the only ones that can wrestle in it. And
yep.
Skateboard and do flips.
No, but his idea was that he wants to train his cat to bring a foreign object into the ring for him. That's a weaponized animal.
That absolutely is. There you go. He could bring the powder. We can go back to Mr. Fuji, but with a cat.
That's we'll right. That. Cat could bring a sledgehammer to the ring. There's all sorts of ideas.
Oof. I think we're onto something. We got $1 million gimmick for Teddy Hart.
Hey, he's already got the gimmick.
Money.
But it's not worth $1 million, I can tell you that.
All right, Brian. Well, always a pleasure, man. I'm loving Dark Matter Radio. I think that's what it's called.
That's right. Dark Matter Radio Network.
Cool. And that was really interesting with the Noah's Ark stuff, too. It just made me think of the Uncharted video games. Just made me want to go try to find the Ark now. So
go find it.
Maybe one of these days.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it. There you go. Weaponized cats bringing a foreign object to a wrestling ring. How about this? Biological rat warfare. Idea of using disease against the enemy started to gain traction. USSR started developing a way to deliver deadly pathogens to enemy lines using rats as a delivery system. Disease that was chosen was tularemia, rabbit fever, a very fast-acting and acute infection that is spread through contact with infected animals and is also respiratory transmissible. You know, I read a book a long time ago. I've never really read up a lot on infectious diseases and that sort of deal, but I remember the book made the case that, you know, people fear like the terrible disease that, you know, you contract it and you're dead within hours. And what if it were highly communicable? What if there was a highly communicable disease that if you got it, Like within a matter of hours, you were dead. And it was, you could spread it to your friends and family. What a terrible thing. It would wipe out civilization. And this guy's argument, which makes sense to me, is that it is not the fast acting. It is not the quick and swift death that you should fear, because a disease that is going to kill you within hours, it actually, honest to God, has less of a chance of spreading throughout the world, because you don't have time to spread it. You don't have time to come in contact with large numbers of people because you're dead so quickly. And so his point was, what you should fear is the slow-moving plague, the one that takes a while to kill you. And thus you're going around and you're spreading it to many, many people before it finally takes you. So a fast-acting and acute infection perhaps is not the best disease to try to spread using biological rat warfare. So there you go, everybody. Weird weaponized animals of World War II. That's up at mysteriousuniverse.org. Photo here on artbell.com. Bigfoot on trail cam, it says. There is a photograph here of a hairy thigh, knee, and calf. It appears here everyone believes that is a moose. What do you think? The one at the top does not look like a Bigfoot at all. It looks like a dog. And I got to say, the thigh, knee, and calf, that does look like a pretty hairy, man-like thigh, knee, and calf. But I will defer to those who spend a lot of time in the woods and say that it appears to be just a moose. But you can check that out at artbell.com. Have you heard of Survivor Man Bigfoot? It's actually a very interesting story. I will read this press release right here. During the making of Survivor Man Alaska in 2009, Survivor Man Les Stroud experienced his first possible Bigfoot encounter. Quote, "The strangest thing happened. I was making my grass mat and all of a sudden a deep and very loud grunting noise about 50 yards away brought me to my feet and put the hairs up on the back of my neck. It repeated 5 times and I have to say it sounded just like a large gorilla." Les acknowledged the experience but didn't speak publicly about it until February 2011, in an interview with 93.3 KZOZ, hosts Jeff and Jeremy in the Morning asked if Les had ever had a Bigfoot encounter. Les unexpectedly opened up about his Alaskan encounter. "It sounded like a big ape. That's all I can tell you," he said. The interview has been viewed over 250,000 times since. Les has decided to uncover the truth. Joined by Bigfoot expert Todd Standing, Les travels to 2 remote Bigfoot hotspots to debunk the myths that surround Bigfoot phenomena. It says here that for expeditions to yield any success, the search must be made by the most elite of wilderness experts who have the experience to film in the extreme conditions one can expect from the most remote locations. It is a 2-part special. It is airing on the Travel and Escape Channel Wednesday, March 19th at 10 Eastern and Wednesday, March 26th at 10 Eastern. Discovery Channel US and Science Channel US, unfortunately, have yet to release air dates. I heard this was excellent. I heard that Les went out there, Les Stroud, and he was very much trying to rule out all possibilities of what he was seeing and hearing and experiencing. And apparently, he came out of it with a very interesting view of the possibility of Bigfoot. So if you get a chance to check this out, When I get an air date, I'll let everybody know. But I was told by people who had seen it that it was excellent. And I have also been told here it apparently has a couple of days ago debuted in the U.S. I was actually reading an old article. This is new. It aired on Wednesday, April 9th on Discovery Channel U.S. at 10 Eastern. If anybody is listening to this right now and can go up and find out when this will be replaying, let me know because I really want to see this. But it has already aired in the U.S., which means that it'll probably re-air again, or it might be available on Hulu or perhaps on iTunes. But I've been told that if you get a chance, check this out because it is a... I'm told it's very good. Read some of the comments here. I saw the picture of Bigfoot on the footage. Not only did I have chills, but I swear that my heart stopped and I forgot to breathe. It is amazing. This was an awesome show, this person says. Les just keeps making progressively better work. I saw 5 different images that look like Bigfoot. He has outdone virtually all previous experts in one show. Love the show. Thought the Bigfoot was the best show to date. Wants to know when part 2 will air. A lot of great comments right here. After seeing Todd Standing's video, says Jim, I'm going to have to rethink this Bigfoot thing. Scary video. And finally, Liz here says, wow, Les, great show. Anyone that does not believe that Bigfoot exists needs to have their head examined. Les Stroud and Todd Standing are experienced outdoorsmen. They don't strike me as flaky people. Bigfoot is definitely out there. I cannot wait for part 2. Keep up the search, Les. We will be watching. So check it out, everybody. Discovery US, Survivor Man Bigfoot. It premiered on Wednesday, April 9th. Check it out if it replays. And if anybody knows when it will replay, let me know, please. And with that, my friends, we are out of time. But fear not, if you are listening live. In just a moment, we will be back. We are going to be doing a After Dark After Show with Keith Rowland. We're going to be talking all sorts of different topics here. And it should be a good time. Again, it is only for those of you that are listening live. If you're listening on the replay, that is a good reason for you to listen live next week. If you listen live, you can hear the post show. If not, it's not anywhere. It is a special treat only for those of you listening live. And I know there's a lot of you out there right now listening live. It's coming up in just a moment. Don't forget, everybody, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. That is our website. Everything you ever want to know about the show is up there. This show will be replaying at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, not only on the Dark Matter Radio Network on Saturday, but it will be available for a free download up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. It stays up there for a week, and then after the show airs, a new show goes up. So make sure if you're listening to this at this exact moment, you go up right now and grab the Joseph P. Farrell Show. It's not going to be up there for much longer. So head up there and check that out. Make sure you check out ArtBell.com. And of course, everything you ever want to know about the After Dark Radio Show is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, including links to all of our different Twitters, Facebook, the whole nine yards. You can follow me on Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. And you can also head over to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow, and check that out. So as noted, support the show, everybody. We'll be back next week. We got a lot of big guests coming up. It's going to be a good time. So I want to thank all of you for listening and participating as always. And again, we shall be back in just a moment with the After Dark After Show here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.